ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hi, you're listening to episode 105 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray, recorded on the 1st of November 2020. We were off last week, as you would have known, and I really hope you had a really blessed puja. WhatsApp Geeks was off last week too, but we did have a new episode of Binge On, and this time it featured some Tamil and Telugu recommendations from the amazing movies made by one of our greatest Indian filmmakers, K. Balachandar. So you can look for Binge on your podcast player or head over to fourspire.net to subscribe and listen. Lots of love and little bit of hate coming in for this episode, but we would love to receive lots more of both. And now back to Attention Plus with your host who's giving Freddy Krueger a run for his money. Hey Arnab.
Hello. Hello Vikram. Hello everyone. Yes, today we had Halloween, which happens to be my favorite. I can't call it a religious occasion, but it just happens to be my favorite occasion for the year. It has kind of emerged over the years as my the occasion that I enjoy the most, perhaps because religion is so little a part of it. It's not so much a religious occasion as it is a social occasion, and I thoroughly enjoy the joy of dressing up and of becoming somebody different than who I am. I think this is.
Your whole family in on it?
Yes. So if you're added as a Facebook friend, you'll see that you know there's loads of pictures. There's my daughter she wrote a poem. Actually, she wrote a poem which is a part of a story that she's writing, and she recited that poem. It's a poem written by her. I think it's very, very good as a poem. So she recited that. She is dressed up this year as a huntress. So we did a little bit of a jungle theme in the background. So we did that. My wife dressed as, she has a vampire dress. She was dressed as that. This time was the first time in my life that I decided to forego a mask and instead did makeup. So my wife did this makeup it was basically a zipper. So my face was being unzipped and there was blood inside. It actually, I don't know if you saw the picture.
I did. I mean, that's why I said you have topped Freddy Krueger.
Yes. So it was a fairly successful experiment. I've avoided doing that because I always felt that this would be very difficult to pull off, but it was not that difficult. I mean, it was made easy by the fact that the only thing that had to be colored was inside the zipper. So it was not a full face makeup, but I think next time, and also this time there was no office event, so I wasn't going to wear a mask. If this was office, I couldn't have done it. But since I was at home, this was the perfect opportunity to do it. So I think this was a good decision.
Before we go on to the topics for today, I mean, I know we are not you're not officially covering IPL this time, but in the last one, which was 2 weeks ago, when you had done a roundup of IPL, Kings XI Punjab was at the bottom. And Deccan Chargers again. Delhi Capitals was all set to easily stride into the playoffs. And yet here we are. So my question is, has this been the closest IPL we've had that you remember?
No, I think I think the very nature of IPL is such that usually, and this has been true, I would say after, first two or three IPLs, I think there was a vast disparity in the standards of the different teams. Some teams just understood from the first auction how an IPL franchise should be constructed, and some teams didn't. And it took many years to catch up because they kind of missed the boat the first time. So it's, I guess it's taken almost 10 years now. You know, how long has IPL? 10, 12 years now. 12 for years. For basically all the teams to kind of come to a state of equilibrium. I think this was, in a way, there are two things which made this a very, very good IPL. First of all, I think that it going to these three stadiums and the fact that, again, when this tournament started, I was a little apprehensive, you know, how the tournament would be without a live audience, whether that would itself kind of reduce the intensity of the games. And I think it didn't. Of course, it started out a little lukewarm. I think the players took some time to warm up to it, and that was why I think Mumbai Indians lost the first game. But this was a very, very evenly balanced IPL tournament. It was even more evenly balanced because I felt that since all of them played in three stadiums, there was not a distinct home and away advantage as it normally is. So, in for instance, Chennai has benefited a lot from having Chennai as their home base and creating teams that basically enable them to win games in Chennai consistently. On the other hand, Bangalore has consistently struggled because they've had a decent team, but their team has never been good for Chinnaswamy. So they've always kind of, this again started from the fact that Bangalore from the very first auction, they blew it in terms of the players they should have selected. And even when they got people, it was never, I never felt that they had a team which was good for their home turf. And finally, they in this tournament, they have a chance to play at a quote-unquote neutral venue. Everybody's playing in a neutral venue. And I think it suited Bangalore's game much more than if this tournament had been played in India.
Last time we had a complete tournament in neutral venue was, the South Africa one.
South Africa, which yes.
Hyderabad one. but as you notice, as we get closer to the, to the end of the tournament, though currently, yesterday's match, we have Sunrisers in the fourth position, but it is getting very close to what you had predicted initially.
Yes, so as I said, Punjab was an exceptional team. I mean, from the beginning of the tournament, when I looked through Punjab, I thought this is a great team. And Punjab had some bizarre decisions, and as you can see, the tide for Punjab turned the moment they played Chris Gayle. That's it. If Chris Gayle wasn't playing against the game in Kolkata, they would have lost it. Simple. So Chris Gayle has been the difference. Chris Gayle has been, and this is the magic of T20. Because of its played over 20 overs, it just requires one person to be in form for a team to advance. Like, for instance, the fact that Kolkata Knight Riders has been an absolute shit outfit for years has been hidden by the fact that they've always had Andre Russell performing. And now you see what a bunch of shit that franchise actually is. So it has kind of been held aloft by, super performers. And it has been held aloft to an extent by Andre Russell, to a certain extent by Sunil Narayan. And as the tournament has progressed, I've seen, and this, of course, I didn't quite realize that one of the things that possibly has led to Sunil Narayan's success, and I think I read that in Crick Info, and it was a very valid point. I think it was Crick Info, if I'm not mistaken. But it's a very, very valid point that in order for Narayan to succeed as an opener, he needs to be paired with somebody like Chris Lynn. Because the thing between Chris Lynn and Narayan is that Chris Lynn can't play spin, he can play pace. And Narayan can't play pace, he can play spin. So when you put both of them together, all they need to do is change the strike whenever some bowler comes on. And they can hit the guy. And that, since Chris Lynn, they decided to let Chris Lynn go, that advantage was gone. And this time, everybody knew that when Narayan comes to open, this is what we're going to do. We're not going to let him play against spin. Which is why it worked when they let Narayan go two drop, because he was able to play spin. He was able to play Ashwin when he came into bat. But overall, you can see that it's a very, very, very subtle change in strategy. No brainer, really. Letting Chris Gayle bat has been the biggest, that's really what was the difference between Punjab winning and Punjab losing. Just one person who was sitting and they were not playing Chris Gayle. It was not really obvious to me initially why Chris Gayle wasn't playing. Because, it wasn't that he was obviously injured. Because, in terms of his Instagram, I think, it seemed a little pissed off that he was not playing. So, I never quite understood why Chris Gayle wasn't playing. But I still think that Punjab should drop Maxwell. Because he hasn't contributed at all. I think they would be even more formidable outfit if they dropped Maxwell. And if they played, I don't know, who is sitting. Well, that's the problem. Their bench strength is so weak that even Maxwell kind of makes it in. But he's not had one single match-winning performance in all these games. Not one. So I'm happy that my prediction about Kings XI and Punjab actually turned out true, because when I'd start tournament started, I was very, very excited for them. I thought that they had finally got together a very, very well-rounded squad, and I've been proven right. And I, again, from the get-go, Rahul's performance, if you look at the last three IPLs, has been absolutely stellar. He has topped, I think, 500 to, if I'm not wrong, he scored 600 runs in every IPL from 2018, 2019, 2020. That is an absolutely fantastic, fantastic record. And of course, I don't know what, it's obviously Vijay Mallya brains that I guess the legacy of of RBC that they left, that they let him go. I don't know why anybody would let, you know, him go. I think that, you know, some again, what I find amazing is that sometimes players struggle in one franchise and then they go and become a superstar in another. Like, for instance, I think the biggest example of that is Surya Kumar Yadav. He played in Calcutta. He was initially the first franchise he played for Kolkata. And he was never a big success. I mean, he used to come to bat at 5 or 6. And, you know, he never looked much better than, let's say, a Nikhil Nayak or anybody. He never looked like he was exceptional. But then he went to Bombay and Mumbai Indians, and they gave him the opportunity to open. And see, sometimes what I feel is that with players, it's often a matter of confidence. It's a matter of telling somebody, look, this is your role, and we're going to give you some time to grow into the role. And you have a very definite role. With Surya Kumar Yadav, when he was in KKR, because it's a pathetically managed franchise by an insurance salesman, there is absolutely no clarity in roles for anybody. If you look through the tournament, you'll find that nobody in the side has had a very clear, defined role. Nobody. Karthik, for instance, is he going to play? And he was the captain. So you would hope that he is the first person who should have a clearly defined role. But even he didn't have a clearly defined role. And sometimes he would come to bat in the 7th or 8th over. Sometimes he would come to bat in the 15th over. And these are two very, very different skills, two very different roles in a T20 game, to come into bat in the 7th or 8th over. And if you just magnify it for the 50 over game, this is the difference between somebody who comes to bat in the 15th over and a guy who comes to bat in the 45th over. So his success is much better when he comes to bat after the 15th over. Unfortunately, he was repeatedly put in a position where, I mean, he's not a great player that he can bat at any position, right? But even then, he was put in the position in which he was most likely to fail consistently. And again, with Shubman Gill, this consistent, the main problem with KKR is that they just didn't have any firepower at the top. This is the reason why they're going to be eliminated. And I actually want Kolkata to be eliminated, because I don't think that they can last. Even if they make it through, they can't last the first game with the kind of team that they have. There's virtually nobody there who can score runs at the clip that's needed on these pitches, unfortunately. And it's just a miracle that they made like 210 or 200 in one of their initial games. But consistently, they don't have the batsmen to make it. I'm also happy that Rajasthan is actually doing well at the end, because I've always felt that Rajasthan has, in terms of the cricketers, in terms of the four foreign players that they have the best four foreign players among all the teams. Because they have the world's, as I said before, they're the world's best fast bowler, Jofra Archer. They have the world's best all-rounder, Ben Stokes, and he's proven it towards the end. You know, what a great asset he is. And he's always, I felt, underperformed in IPL, considering the kind of batsman he is. For those of you who follow English cricket, you know, the kind of influence he has, it's nowhere close to the kind of influence he's had in IPL. He is like light years ahead of, let's say, an Andre Russell in terms of, you know, his raw ability, both with the bat and the ball, and of course with fitness. Andre Russell is absolutely unfit. But if you look at his IPL numbers, and if you ask somebody who is a more valuable player, they would obviously, everybody would choose Andre Russell. So ultimately, I think class is coming out, and at least on these pitches, he's showing the difference between him and, you know, the other wannabe all-rounders. They also have Steve Smith, who arguably is the second best cricketer batsman in the world. And then they have Jos Buttler, who is, still after A.B. de Villiers, because A.B. de Villiers is a genius, is still the world's best 360 player, in the sense that he can basically play a you can hit a six at anywhere. So I'm glad that Rajasthan is also making a late run. I hope that the final four are obviously Mumbai, Delhi, Bangalore, and Punjab. I hope, because I think these teams have just been the best in terms of, you know, Delhi has kind of dropped off at towards the end. So if anybody of these four, I would perhaps say Delhi is suddenly hit. It's suddenly, I don't know what's happened to the team. Inexplicable loss of form for all of these players. So I'm not 100%
they realize they're Delhi.
They're Delhi, of course. 100%, but I still say that in terms of their overall performance over the last 1.5 months, I think that these four are the most deserving teams in the playoffs. Okay, so moving on to the two topics. So the first topic that I wanted to cover was France and Macron and the beheading in France. And of course, the feverish reaction across the world to Macron's statement. Now, the point that this is what I find interesting is the very nature of, so Macron is, you know, a French socialist. So when Macron came to power, you would find many of our Indian liberals, you know, applauding that, look, finally we have a leader of the world, Macron, who is not like Modi, the evil Modi and the evil Trump, look at him, you know. But of course, these people don't know that there's a very different nature of French secularism versus the Desi brand of secularism. So the French secularism, so France was really after World War. So France was a pretty religious country before World War. And after World War II finished, there was a vast, I would say, loss of faith of the whole country in the established Catholic Church. And Protestant, it was mostly Catholic, you know, in terms of what about God in general. And at that point of time, communism kind of filled in the vacuum. And if you look at early 1950s, there was a huge, huge outburst of writing on communism, on Marxism, on socialism coming in from France. It kind of became the intellectual fountainhead of Marxism, where you have Camus, you have Sartre, you have a whole lot of these Marxist thinkers. But one of the founding principles of the French way of thinking about secularism is something which I can solidly get behind. It is not this whole punching up, punching down thing. It is to be radically skeptical of any kind of dogma and any kind of radicalism. So that was really the foundation of what the French way of thinking of Marxism was. That there will be no holy cows. We will make fun of everyone. It will be the church. It will be Islam. At that point of time, Hinduism wasn't even known, but if they knew, it would be Hinduism. It didn't matter. We will make fun of any dogmatic religious structure, any pantheon of gods. We will make fun of it. We will subject it to reason, irrespective of the religion, irrespective of the consequence. That is really the cornerstone of what French Marxist thinking was. Now, even within the French Marxist movement, there was a division on this. It wasn't that everybody agreed to it. In a past episode, I had referred to this, the famous falling out between Camus and Sartre, where the main thing between the thing was that when Sartre came to know about the fact that the Russians, the USSR, were having concentration camps, which were not dissimilar in any shape or form to what Hitler had. His first reaction was that we shouldn't let anybody know about this. Camus was shocked. He said, "What are you talking about? This is criminal. What they're doing? They have forced labor camps. We have to tell the world that this is going on." He said, "No, why should we? I'm not supporting it, but we have to understand that our allies are the Marxists in Russia, And if we do this, what we do is we strengthen the hands of the anti-Marxists all around the world. So what good does it serve? Just because it's the truth doesn't necessarily mean we should go and tom-tom it, because what purpose will it serve? It will do much more harm than good if we go and tell that this is what is going on in the USSR. Of course, Camus went ahead and still said it. But this essentially became, from then on, what Marxism became in other parts of the country. This is exactly what we see in India. This let's hide. I mean, there is this scale which is not equal for every religion. Some religions get away with a lot and some religions don't. And this was never really a part of core Marxism. Core Marxism was very non-discriminatory in this respect, with respect to putting all religions under the prism. Now, and there was also another historic reason why this happened. See, the iconic struggle, political struggle after World War II became the struggle over Palestine. And over here, initially the struggle between the Palestinians and the Arab world, and of course on one side, and Israel and America on the other side, was a struggle which was framed as a struggle between capitalism, imperialism, and Marxism. So if you look at the initial Arab leaders, they were all, including Saddam, the Ba'ath Party itself was a Marxist party. So initially the struggle in Palestine was framed, and it was true, it was a struggle between a secular resistance, which was Marxist in nature, versus Zionism, and backed by US, which was considered to be the great devil. So this was the way the struggle was phrased in the 60s. And then after the war with Israel, in which basically the Arabs just couldn't agree, and so they were all disunited, Israel basically compromised a few of them. So when they attacked Israel altogether from all sides, what happened is that all of them got defeated by Israel. And not only that, Israel went ahead and then took away their lands. So it was a disaster. And it was then that the Arab world realized that Marxism wasn't strong enough to bind all these countries together. It was just not that strong a fabric. So at that point of time, the struggle for Palestine became intrinsically linked to radical Islam as a part of Islamic revival. And the Palestinian Liberation Army and all of these were, even, of course, if you have, this is not secular French parties, there were always a strong Islamic component of it, but at least nominally they were secular. Many of the leaders, for instance, were actually Christians, believe it or not. But ultimately, over the 70s, it gradually started getting into the hands of Islamic hardliners. Now, this presented a curious quandary to the Marxist intellectuals in France and in other centers of the world, in the US, in London. So how do they reconcile this? Should they then oppose this new Islamic fundamentalism? But if they did so, that would put them in the camp of the evil American imperialist. So which side would they go to? So at that point of time, they decided to loosen their theory. So rather than going after religious dogma everywhere, they began that punching up, punching down thing that we talk about. They decided to make a distinction between certain religions and certain communities which were being punched down, and certain religions and communities which attacking them was considered punching up. So that is when the model of French Marxism, the what drives, let's say, Macron, that was broken for what we currently have in India today. What currently passes off as liberalism in India is basically the descendant of this line of thinking, which says that there are asymmetric standards. And this asymmetry is born from what essentially Sartre said, that it is not a question of having a principle and sticking to it. They're smart enough to know that this is not a principled stance in any shape or form. But they believe that in order, and this is the word Realpolitik, which I believe comes from German, I'm not sure, is that the Realpolitik dictates that we should adopt allies. And in this case, and especially this was true in the case of Palestine, and it is true in the case of Kashmir, which is also a primarily Islamic movement. It is not a secular freedom movement, that they decided that we should ally with these in order to, the enemy of an enemy is a friend, following that principle, because there's no way that we would be on the same side as Americans in Palestine, Americans and Israelis in Palestine, and Indians slash Hindus and the Hindu fascist state on this side. So we will not be part of those, because those are all parts of the punch up part. So we will be part of this, even though we don't agree fundamentally with many of the things they say. We don't agree because they don't. I mean, that's one of the fundamental tenets of Marxism, is that religion is the opium of the masses. I mean, that's how it starts. So even, but we shall also stay silent. We shall stay silent when one side does fundamentalism and extremism. We will then kind of turn our back to it and pretend that it's not happening. But when it happens on the other side, we shall be absolutely trenchant and first, you know, run right into the trenches with our rifles and bayonets pulled when that happens. And then when somebody points to the other side, we will use different kinds of, you know, academic chicanery, like whataboutism, to prevent you from saying something. So if you try to point out our hypocrisy, we will attack you back. So this then became the standard. And what we see today on social media isn't particularly novel. This is the Marxist way of attacking intellectuals. It was perfected in England, in France later on, in universities in India. So this is not anything new. What you now find on social media and on, you know, YouTube channels and on Facebook pages is a mainstreamization of that. It's not that any of these, you know, rhetorical techniques are anything novel. They're not particularly novel at all. So one of the things which I remembered saying in a very early episode was that I grew up with a lot of Marxists, because my dad's friends in IIM were all Marxists, but many of them were actually trained in the French school. So they were very, very fair when it came to fundamentalism. They were not like these guys. They were not these guys who now rule the roost. They're not the guys who support these things tacitly. And you have a Congress MLA coming and supporting and saying that, you know, endorsing violence against Macron. And, you know, none of the Congress bigwigs have said anything about it. Now, if you imagine if somebody in BJP had done this, and they do it all too. So people will say monkey balancing. No, it's not monkey balancing. The BJP does it too. But at that point of time, you'll find Rahul Gandhi coming up with a condemnation and saying, why isn't Modi ji saying anything? Why isn't people who Modi ji follow saying anything? Why isn't, and this is not just something which Rahul Gandhi will say, because Rahul Gandhi is the opposition, he has to say. This is what the Rajdeep Sardesais will say. This is what the Rana Ayubs will say. This is what the Barkhadats will say. This is what the Sardesais will say. But if it's turned around now like this, you will find that they will all be silent. There will be no call for accountability from Rahul Gandhi, that why is an MLA who's not like a member of Congress? You know, you can say, well, anybody can be a member of Congress if they pay the chanda. But he's an MLA. So if an MLA says something like this, surely there should be some amount of condemnation. There should be some action taken from a party which claims to be secular. But it isn't, right? We all know that it isn't. And the problem with this is, by doing this, the Congress actually gives, and this is the tragedy of it all, that for those people who want to follow the middle path of true secularism, by doing this, by essentially turning the other way, these people actually provide the fire to the radical Hindu right. Because the radical Hindu right will justifiably say, see, this is exactly what we say we do, and they've gone ahead and done it. So if they had come out and strongly condemned, but, you know, even their condemnation is always with a but we should be sensitive. Of course, they are not sensitive to religions which are considered to be in the punch up category. In that case, they don't say, they said there is no reason for being sensitive. You know, you are the oppressor class. We are showing the truth to you. We are speaking truth to power. But in this case, of course, there is no notion of speaking truth to power. Even though there are, I don't know how many, you know, Islamic countries in the world. So it's not as if that there aren't a lot of countries which are Islamic theocracies and which are very powerful, including some of the richest countries in the world with, you know, with great petroleum resources. So again, none of this makes any sense if you look through it, except this stems from real politics, that we should be silent in certain cases. And the problem with this is, and this is the tragedy of it, is this is exactly how Hindu right-wing fundamentalism started. This is how the comparative intolerance started. These things didn't exist in the 80s and the 90s. Now people are looking at Hindi movies and there is a Twitter account which says, look how anti-Hindu all of these things are. But at that point of time, and these are legitimate points that they are making, these now using the measuring sticks that are now used by the BuzzFeeds and Huffingtons of Post of the world for anything else, these are scandalous things that we have seen in Hindi movies about the Hindu religion, and none of us even felt that it was worth being offended about. Because at that point of time, we just didn't think that it was offensive. We just didn't. But at some point of time, these people, these BuzzFeed idiots, they came and said, no, you should be offended about this thing. You should be offended about that thing. And then people said, wait, hold on. Let me just write down what they just said. Now, let's look at movies from the 1970s. Let's look at movies from the 1980s. Oh boy. What did they have in those days? And why did we never feel offended? The fact that we never felt offended was because we were not offended. That's the thing. We were not offended. And by doing this, this is what radicalization is. This is what the centrifuge effect is. This is how one side makes the other side radical and uses that to further their own radicalization. This is exactly what has happened. Now we are going back in history to look at popular culture artifacts in order to feel outrage. Now that we have exhausted the outrage of today, the Tanish Cad and everything, we can now go back to songs in the 1970s and 80s and feel outrage now. So this is what is going on. This is what's happening. And I personally don't, I'm not part of this. I never will be. Because I honestly feel that I believe in the French ideal of all religion. Again, I'm not personally, as a human being, I will not go and intentionally rile anybody up on their religion. This is not anything else. Not that I think that I don't have the right to do it, but it's just a level of unpleasantness that I don't want to get into. That's all. So that is my conscious choice. But I also accept that whatever your line is, your line has to be consistent. You then cannot have this punching up, punching down, which is a very naked way of justifying your hypocrisy and your prejudice. You can't do that. Whatever line it is, it has to be a consistent line. So while I am somebody who is absolutely not for offense, my line of offense is very, very, very high. And I absolutely believe that there should be a lot of artistic freedom. There should be a lot of freedom inside universities. So some of the free speech, some speech that might be incendiary in office, for instance, should be allowed in a university, that there should be certain places where you have the certain safe places where you are allowed to say whatever you want. Unfortunately, this is again where the Marxists have whittled away. They have penalized and made impossible for academics who have opinions inimical to their worldview to say anything in these places, because they feel that these are microaggressions, that there needs to be a trigger warning. So it's they who have vitiated this. And now, of course, the other side is going to play the same game. They're going to say, well, that's the same thing for us then too. And again, the failure of the Congress to condemn, cars running over pictures of Macron, this will ultimately go and hurt the Congress. This will go and hurt anybody who in this country actually wants secularism in the way that it should be, that religion should be something which is kept out of politics, that this actually will this is the biggest image that the Hindu right wing needs, this image to show that, look, this is exactly what we said and this is exactly what is happening. And by not condemning it, I'm happy that, you know, Javed Akhtar and Nasiruddin Shah, they did come out with a mild condemnation. It's not a full condemnation. It's this kind of, but whatever, but anyways, it's not a good thing. And at least they have done so. You have many others. I've forgotten the name. What was his name? Hold on. Munawwar. So this Munawwar Rana, the fact that this Munawwar Rana goes and says that Munawwar Rana stands in support of French attacker, according to DNA India. So if you don't condemn this, if you have Munawwar Rana as part of your platform, and he has been part of the anti-Modi platform for a while, then of course, it's perfectly right for those who are on the Hindu right to point to him and use him as, like, see, everybody else believes in this because they have him in their platform. So this does more harm to quote-unquote secularists than anything that the Hindu right wing can do. And this is something which I think that they honestly struggle to understand. Okay, so moving on to the next topic. So you had some questions on Trump.
Yes. So a little bit of context here. Of course, I, as everyone knows, I am very much in Hyderabad, but I believe in all our family WhatsApp groups. Now, whether or not people are in US, this one of the heated topics is the US elections. And if you going back 4 years, if you remember, Arnab, as you had pointed out, there were a huge number of hashtag not my president when Trump won.
Yes.
Coming from all parts of India. So in that spirit, there were a lot of, depending on which family group or which friends group it is, it's 60-40, either pro-Trump or anti-Trump.
Okay.
And for me, I actually found, there were good points being made and all if you sort through the noise. So before I get to the questions, I mean, would you want to give a roundup of where the elections stand? I mean, currently, what do the polls show? You guys go to vote in 2 days. But I do see that, I mean, there's something called early voting and people have been voting all along.
So they have been voting for a long time this year because of COVID. Normally, people go and vote on election day. So this time, most people apparently have already voted. So there's been a massive early voting this year. So this is, of course, this whole early voting has been an extremely contentious, very, very contentious issue, which the Democrats have want early voting. They want mail-in ballots and the Republicans don't want mail-in ballots. So the reason for that is primarily that one of the ways that Republicans, and this is, again, backed by hard data. So it's not that it's a hunch that they have, of course, it's that. In the US, unlike in India, election day is not a holiday. So for many people, if you have the voting open just on the election day, there are many people who work hourly jobs. And these are the guys who are most likely to be Democrat voters who just are not able to vote because they just don't have the time off. So if they go to vote, that means they're basically losing money to go to vote. And especially in some of the urban areas where there are long lines to vote, this could essentially mean, not working for a whole day and losing your income, which obviously is not possible for many very poor Americans. So the Republicans have consistently tried to make voting as difficult and as time consuming as possible, because their most voters are usually either, they know that these votes they're not going to get. Now with mail-in, this is why Trump has been trying for a long time. To make sure that there are not mail-in ballots. So one of the first things that he did a month ago was he started to defund the United States Postal Service. The only reason why he was started to do this was because he knows that if he's able to defund the US Postal Service, the delivery of mail will get slower. And there's a rule that that in order for a vote to count, it has to be postmarked before November 3rd, which is the date of the election. So what he's trying to look for, and maybe this is one of your questions, and this is now fairly well known, is that what Trump's end game is Trump and his Republican, you know, the think tank is more or less sure that they are going to lose the election at this point of time. If they have a straightforward, legitimate election, the odds are not in their favor. Usually, last time, around this time, which is like 2 days away from the election, Hillary Clinton's lead with Trump was decreasing. It was decreasing continuously. It was decreasing because of the revelations from Comey about the Hillary emails. Whatever it was decreasing at that point of time. In the case of Biden, it has held steady the spread is much more than Hillary had. It's a reasonably safe spread at this point, to 8 to 10 points, that Biden is ahead of Trump. So given that, the end game that many people feel that Trump is going to go with is that he is, on the night of the elections, he is, if the verdict is overwhelmingly against him, that it becomes, based on the votes that are counted on the night itself, that there is no chance in hell, mathematical chance, that he can be the president, then it's one thing. But if that doesn't happen, if it is that a lot of votes haven't still come in, he is going to cry that there has been fraud, and then he's going to take it to court. He's going to take it to Supreme Court. And because of the death of Justice Ginsburg and the appointee of yet another Trump toady to the Supreme Court, which is again a unique thing in US politics, where the US president, and they basically get to appoint Supreme Court judges, that person will then overturn the US elections. Overturn as in they will say that, you know, that there has been massive fraud, and either we need to do it again, or that we will need to delay and do something in order to make Trump stay. That is the fear that people have. If it is an overwhelming verdict, they can't do anything. If it is a close call, like it was in the 2000 election, then yes, that is exactly what they have been working towards. That is exactly why the Supreme Court justice was confirmed. This was done in this haste purely for that, to overturn the election. There is no doubt.
You have answered my first question, where I wanted to ask you whether, would either parties concede gracefully, especially Trump? Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone expects Trump to tweet out saying, yeah, the better person won, and blah, blah, blah. I wish all the best to Joe Biden. That's not something we expect. But on the flip side, now let's say, there is a very clear outcome that, either through the popular vote or even through the Electoral College, that Trump has won. Do you see, I'm not talking specifically about Joe Biden here, but Democrats are in large, saying, okay, I guess, yeah, that's the way it is. Or do you see, large uprising or something like that happening?
No, there will be no large uprising. I mean, I don't know what exactly you mean by uprising, but if you mean like people coming onto the streets and having in an Arab Spring kind of thing, no, that's not going to happen. If Trump wins, the other side is not going to do that. I don't think any side is going to take to the streets. I think whatever is going to happen is going to happen in courts. Now, if Trump overturns the election, then I don't know. That Trump winning is one thing, but Trump overturning an election might be something different. Because that's, again,
explain the difference. When you say overturn, you mean refusing to accept the verdict?
No, not refusing to accept the verdict. That's what I tried to explain. So let's say because of the mass. So in previous years, very few people voted by mail, right? So people went to the election, they voted electronically. They went in, they pressed a button, the vote was registered, and by evening, the votes were in. Okay. Now, because of COVID, that is no longer the case. People are voting by mail, and there will be people who will be putting their mail on November 2nd. Their mail will not reach by November 3rd. So on November 3rd, if the election that's why I said, if the verdict for the Democrats is overwhelming, let's say they've lost Texas, the Democrats win Texas. If Democrats win Texas, I think it's overwhelming at that point of time. But it's still a toss-up what happens in Texas. That is also sensational, that Texas is still a toss-up, given that it's like saying that Gujarat might go to the communists. It's like that. So if the Democrats win Texas, then that's fine. If at the end of, let's say, 12 o'clock at night, if sufficient number of votes are still not in, that can decide whether it's Biden or Trump. At that point of time, then Trump will stop. That's what people believe that he's going to do. And as a matter of fact, he's actually even telegraphed that fact that he's going to do it. It's not even a secret that if it comes that close, they will try to do this. And that is why they have a Supreme Court majority. They will say that there has been massive rigging, which Trump has been saying for so long. Trump and his toadies have been doing that for the last...
Even when he won?
Even when he won, there was no mail-in ballot like this. There were mail-in ballot, but it wasn't that most people were voting by mail-in ballot. There was no COVID then, right?
So the mail-in ballot, is it the EVM Gotala, the US?
Mail-in ballot is just mails.
I'm saying in terms of an excuse. Is it the EVM ka Gotala excuse in the US version?
No, it's the excuse is that there is no confirmation that anybody who's mailed in their vote is actually genuine. Because obviously the process isn't as foolproof. You can go and challenge. So what happens with mail-in ballot is that every house where somebody is registered. So you have to be a registered voter. So unlike, just like in India where you have a voters list, here also you have a voters list. Now, normally what happens in most elections is that you have a voters list on the day of the election. Now, in some states, there are early voting, but you have to go to a booth. There are very few cases in which absentee ballots are used. So in some states, and again, remember, in the US, these rules vary from state to state. So even now, there are some states in which you don't get to have a absentee ballot. That is, you don't get to vote by mail unless you actually go and make an application that, hey, I want to vote by mail. However, in a state like California, which is where I am, every household that has an US citizen and who is registered, they get a vote in the mail. So there is an old school envelope with your name on it, with your signature. And it says under the perjury, I'm going to, this is my vote and this is my signature. Now, obviously, you don't see the vote from the outside of the envelope. So that's what you sign. And inside there is your voting forms where you select who you're going to vote. And that doesn't have your name on it. So when it goes to the election agent, they take the envelope out, see the signature, see that's a registered voter, throw out the envelope, then bring out the piece of paper and they count it. Now, this is not, and because of COVID, most votes have come in like this. Now, in other years, this is not the way it happens. In other years, these are a very, very small, very, very small fraction of votes come in by mail. They're called absentee ballots. They're very small. And they're so small that they don't really change the nature of elections. So you can count them 5 days later. Who cares? The people have already won. All that's needed is basically to know the margin of victory. This time is different. This time, this is the bulk of the vote. So that means that unless every vote that they count is a Democratic vote, it is unlikely that on the night of the election, you can call the election for one of the candidates. Now, do you understand now?
Yep.
So if you cannot call it on the night of the elections, then Trump will say, and he has already said so. This is, again, not conjecture. Trump has already said that there's been massive rigging. All these votes that are coming, these are massively rigged by Democrats. And so on that night, he will say, there's been rigging. They will obviously have some incidents they will create. And then they will take it to the Supreme Court. Their major thing is to take it to the Supreme Court, where basically taking it to the Supreme Court, where they have a 6-4 majority, which means they can overturn the election at that point of time. That is, so that's why most people are saying that in order for you to kick out Trump, the verdict has to be overwhelming. If it is like a Bush versus Gore thing, where it is a few thousand votes in a few counties in Florida, then Trump will win.
But the reverse doesn't apply. Trump can afford to win by a slimmest of margins, but Biden has to win.
Trump won't win. Yes, Trump, because the Supreme Court is conservative, right? And Trump has shown that, you know, what Trump has done over the last few years is he's pushed the Overton window to such an extent. There's nothing really that he will not do. That things that were considered to be undoable in the US are now being done by Trump. So before, the concept of somebody overturning an election was something which Americans said we always felt happened in like tin pot dictatorships. If the leader doesn't like the elections, they decide it, they call it illegal. We used to laugh at it.
Like
at
that how point Putin wins big in the Russian elections.
they, in one of the prisons, we're saying we used to laugh at it. We used to say, oh, this happens in all these tin pot banana republics. Now we know it's going to happen in a few days' time here. And I honestly want to believe it won't happen, but given the other things which I thought wouldn't have happened and which have happened, I'm not sure anymore.
Okay. Now, you did mention that at this point, currently, Biden is leading in most polls. So, yes. Similarly, you also did mention that though, in the 2016 elections, Clinton was leading, though by a much slimmer margin. So, eventually, that was all attributed to this so-called shy Trump voters, where people felt kind of embarrassed or bullied to say that they were going to vote for Trump. So they invariably tell pollsters, yeah, I'm voting a Democrat. So have the polls right now taken into account that, you know, you have people who might flat out lie to the pollsters, you know, not that it's illegal.
So some people are saying, so again, that could be true. First of all, in 2016, there were many people who were ashamed of voting for Trump. But over the last 4 years, I think that the 4 years of Trump has emboldened these people, many of these people. So I don't think they're any more ashamed of voting for Trump. See, one of the reasons why people were ashamed for voting for Trump in 2016 was at that point of time, his most famous job before that he had held was the host of a reality show.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, people were afraid that if I'm an intelligent person and I tell a friend or a relative that, look, I have on one hand this, you know, definitely corrupt, there's no doubt about it, but Trump is also corrupt. I'm definitely corrupt, but this person who has had a stellar career in politics has basically ticked every box that's needed in order to be the president, has done everything, foreign affairs jobs, domestic affairs jobs, healthcare reform jobs, everything. And on the other hand, I have this other guy who's never held office in his life, who's famous only for marrying East European models and who ran a reality show. Now, I'm afraid that if I say that I'm voting for this other guy, people will think that I'm mad. It's like going to people and saying I'm voting for KRK, right? Like people will not. He's no different than KRK, actually. I mean, he has an identical profile to KRK. So that's the reason why people didn't. But once he's become the president, it's no longer that, right? He's no longer a reality show star. He's now the president of the US. So first of all, I don't think that shy Trump voter effect even exists. But even if it does, the comforting thing for me is that the spread that Biden now has, which is 8 to 10 points, is extensive enough to override that effect. Now, of course, there are people like Michael Moore who are like, who finally Michael Moore, the main thing is Michael Moore does to elections what I do for KKR. So he tries to reverse jinx. So he keeps on saying, no, Trump will win. And he says that, he actually says that because he says that if I don't say that, then people will stay at home and not go to vote. So he basically keeps on telling people that Trump is going to win. So he came up with this article again where he said, look, Trump is going to win because of the shy Trump voter, that this 8%, that this 8% lead that Joe Biden has, it's going Trump. There are 4% of people who don't poll because they're ashamed of saying that they vote for Trump. And once you factor in that 4%, the 4%, it's 8 minus 4 is 4, and 4 becomes part of margin of error. So at that point, so according to him, there is no lead. Now this is again a very outlier position. Most people who understand statistics, and I say this is not likely that this is going to happen. As of now, you know, Biden's lead is very strong, 8 to 10%. He's ahead of Trump, and the only place where Biden has lost anything is in Texas, and this is And this is unique saying because a few weeks ago, he was being projected to win Texas comfortably, which is, again, as I said, it's like, you know, communists winning Gujarat. That may or may not happen. It's still a statistically dead heat in Texas, which says something that, you know, Trump is struggling to hold on to Texas. But and Texas is a huge state. So if anybody loses Texas, that's, you know, a Republican losing Texas is like a Democrat losing California. If you lose this state, you've basically lost the election at that point, because that's really the major thing that you're getting, right? So both Texas as well as Georgia are shaking now for the Republicans. And these are solid red states, both of them.
So it's normal for any president or any government, for that matter, in its second term to lose, you know, due to anti-incumbent syndrome, they'll lose a certain demographic. But is there any demographic that you think Trump might have gained since 2016?
I think white nationalists, definitely. But I think...
But wouldn't they have also voted for him back in 2016?
They wouldn't have voted for Hillary Clinton, but they might have stayed home. So there are many people, in terms of, you want to energize the base. So then you might have a lot of people who support you, but they don't get up in the morning and go and vote for you. So what Trump has done, he's definitely mobilized his white nationalist base. That he definitely has. I'm pretty sure that there will be a huge amount of votes from them. I don't think anybody is going to sit on their couch and not vote. Now, the thing is, again, that his white nationalist base is going to be concentrated in the North Dakota, South Dakota, as an all of the world. So this is like, you know, let's say Bernie Sanders rallying California. It doesn't matter, actually, because those votes don't matter because of the way the Electoral College is. So, after some time, it doesn't really matter. So if you're winning a state, it doesn't matter how big you win. So for Trump, you know, it's in the US, it's all about like four or five swing states. So these four or five swing states are the ones that determine whoever wins those four or five states ultimately wins the elections, because all of the other states actually go, it's pretty sure everybody knows which way they are going to vote. Now, as I said, if you're able to remove one of these bulwark states, like Texas, for instance, if you're able to swing Texas, then the Republican candidate is basically, they've lost at that point of time. If somebody swings Texas, somebody swings California. I'm not 100% sure, but again, with my history, but I think Ronald Reagan won California.
Last
Republican to win California.
Okay. Arnold Schwarzenegger, I know he was a governor, right? And he was also a Republican, if I'm not wrong.
Yes. So one of the things about American politics is that even very, very Democratic states, they vote Republicans to their state. This is a strange thing. But you'll find, for instance, that Massachusetts, for instance, which is a very, very Democratic state, had Mitt Romney as their governor at one point of time. California had Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now, these states, these Republican governors are a little bit of an outlier. So these people normally get elected in state elections because mostly, and this I read somewhere, is mostly because of taxes. Because rich people, you know, more than the federal taxes, it's some of the state taxes that they believe that, you know, so Boston, Massachusetts, also a very rich person state. California, very rich person state. There are some poor people in California, of course, a lot, but mostly very, very rich state. So there are places very in Democratic, who vote absolutely overwhelmingly Democrat during the US elections, but they will from time to time vote Republican governors. And even these Republican governors are not, even if you look at Schwarzenegger, was very, very center moderate Republican. Like, he's very virulently anti-Trump, as you know. He was also somebody who's very pro-environment. He's very, very strong environment. Now, normally the Republicans are not pro-environment. So even, you know, a California Republican is a very different from, you know, a Republican, let's say, in Idaho. Very, very different. So in order to get elected, you know, to be a viable candidate in California, and even Mitt Romney, for instance. And Mitt Romney, when he was in Boston, he basically instituted what was then was a Romneycare, which was really the inspiration for which Obama built Obamacare. As Obama once pointed out that, you know, the problem is that, you know, we this whole thing is based on Romney, but Romney is too embarrassed to say it because, you know, he this is something which he should be proud to take credit, but he's afraid of that. Because, of course, this is against the Republican platform, but he was the first person to implement it. Because, again, that's why also you'll find that Romney is very anti-Trump. So all of these are moderate Republicans. And so, you know, moderate Republicans classically, you know, again, I've said this before, that there was a huge space before for moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats. So Nancy Pelosi, you know, Nancy Pelosi, if you listen to her speaking, mostly you would forget if she's a Republican or a Democrat. She's a very, very, she can be anything, honestly. Same with Mitt Romney, same with, let's say, Schwarzenegger. It's only the extremes, and these extremes started coming out of the woodwork around the time Obama got elected, which was when social media started taking off. It started off with the Tea Party, which is really, you know, there was somebody called Michelle Bachmann. And the Tea Party was the first round of right-wing nutcases. Of course, the most famous leader of that was Sarah Palin. And, you know, nowadays with Trump, you find that the Tea Party people were reasonable. But they were the first extreme fringe group that came in and started challenging the Republican moderate core itself. So they set up extreme Republican, extreme right-wing candidates against established Republicans to defeat them in their own races. And so they started becoming dead afraid of the Tea Party. And so the Republicans started swinging right. Similarly, as a reaction in the left, then, you know, the Ocasio-Cortez's, the Black Lives Matter, and all of those were formed as a reaction, to as a kind of a pressure group within the Democrat Party to move them to the left. So and then Trump came. So, as I was saying in the first half of the podcast, the moment extreme guy on the other side comes, the biggest advantage is for the extremists of the other side. So moderates don't gain. Whenever you have an extremist on one side, the biggest gainer is the extremist on the other side. So that's right. Exactly what happened. And then the AOCs and the Bernies came up. They were a reaction to the Tea Party.
Now, okay, this next thing which I'm going to ask you, this is something which I've seen blow up on almost all WhatsApp groups, which is, and I admit I've not read too much into this news story, but the point is that there is a scandal involving Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, very interesting mm-hmm. name. Mm-hmm. And the point made by the Trump supporting folks was that if the shoe was on the other foot, if the similar scandal had happened, let's say with Donald Trump's son Don Jr., all the media would be all over this, but reporting it not just in US but also in India. But because it is Joe Biden's son, this thing has received no coverage. And yes, I can tell you for a fact that at least in my newspaper, I've not seen anything about this. So is there any truth to this? And explain a little bit about what exactly this scandal is for folks like me.
Okay. So first of all, you have to understand that the definition of corruption in the US once Trump has taken over power has changed dramatically. So in 2016, the big scandal was before that, in 2014, the biggest presidential scandal in a year was that Obama had worn a suit which people considered to be too casual for a president. Okay, this was the worst thing that the president did, which got a lot of airtime on Fox News, that the President Obama was wearing a kind of whitish suit. I'm not making this up. And then people showed that the same kind of color of suit was worn by Ronald Reagan. So they said, you know, what kind of a guy wears this kind of a light suit? So this was the level of what a presidential scandal was in 2012. If you recall, Bill Clinton, the level of presidential scandal was, this was a man who was having an extramarital affair. If you recall that, right?
Yes.
This was the level that got him impeached. With Trump, it was not even disputed that he was having sex with porn stars while being married and while his wife was pregnant. And he was paying hush. The scandal wasn't the fact that he was having an extramarital affair. That was the level of the scandal in the 1990s. Now, it was perfectly fine because it was Trump. What was the scandal was that he was basically using election money to pay hush money to these porn stars. That was the scandal. Okay. So the level, and then it became that Trump was essentially a stool pigeon for the KGB. Now, in the days of COVID, this we will call the new normal, right? So the level of what is considered corruption has changed. So yes, what Hunter Biden did, so what Hunter Biden is accused of doing is that Hunter Biden in China and in Ukraine, he got a lot of contracts because he was basically Joe Biden's son. Now, this is for us who have grown up in India, I mean, this is exactly what sons of politicians do, right? Why is Jay Shah the BCCI head? What other thing does he have other than his last name Shah? So, if politician ka chokra agar ye nahi karega, to karega kya? That's why people go into politics. So, in terms of American levels of political propriety, this would be considered to be a big scandal if this was 2016. But by this time in 2020, Trump has, I mean, what has Trump done? So in 2016, yes, the big scandal was that Hillary Clinton had sent emails from a server which was not a US approved server, that she was using her own personal server to send emails. And why was she doing that? It was fairly obvious. She did not want those emails to be tracked. That's the pretty obvious. So yeah, that was the worst. But what was the worst that Trump was accused of doing? Everybody around Trump, and it was the only way Trump got around effectively was because they had the House and the Senate, was that it was fairly obvious that he had violated election, the ways election was conducted, by taking privileged information from Russians. Now, whether there was official, whether he was a Russian stool pigeon, whether he was an agent of Putin, I don't know. I don't think that was ever proven. However, it was sufficiently proven that his election campaign took help from a political force which was inimical to American interests. It's similar to if you found out that one of our political parties, in order to get elected, was helped by Pakistan. This is exactly similar to that. Whether that person is actually been paid by Imran Khan is another thing, but they definitely took help from Pakistan, and that's been proven. The amount of outrage that would be there, this is what Hunter Biden is being evaluated against. So yes, given that this is what the other guy is doing, and if you look at Trump's own sons, if you look at, for instance, take as a very example, Trump's favorite daughter, Ivanka. So while Trump was having negotiations with the Chinese, the same Chinese he now hates and says, China virus, China flu, Ivanka Trump's business got a lot of, I think, patents and rights to work in China while those talks were going on. So in terms of this level of corruption, in a way, Trump has normalized it. So yeah, there is no doubt in my mind that, you know, Hunter Biden, you know, this is considered corruption. It used to be considered corruption by US standards 4 years ago. But given where Trump has dragged the country and the enormous fatigue, the US has become somewhat like India. In the sense, they have come to accept ki ye to wo karega hi. In India, it's not a big deal, right? Nobody cares.
Because it's expected, everybody, yeah,
absolutely. Is expected. I mean, what else? I mean, as Bhajan Lal once said, that, you know, who will I make the chief minister? Bansilal ka chora ko banaunga kya? So that's the thing. I mean, that's the assumption. I mean, look at Lalu Yadav's son. I mean, does anybody raise a question as to why Lalu Yadav's son was a contracted player for the Delhi Daredevils? No, right? There's no doubt in my mind that the only reason why he was a contracted player for Delhi Daredevils was because he was Lalu Yadav's son.
I forgot. Now, the Hunter Biden
thing is Hunter Biden thing is precisely that. There's no difference. Has anybody ever seen Lalu Yadav's son on a cricket field? Like, does he? I mean, that's the thing. He used to play for Delhi Daredevils. For those of you, I'm not making this up. He was a contracted player for Delhi Daredevils. I don't think he even sat on the bench, if I'm not wrong. I've never seen him on the bench also. But he was a contracted player for the Delhi Daredevils. So how do you think these things happen? So this is considered to be a perk of the job. If your dad is a vice president, this is what happens. And this is, again, this is exactly what the Clinton Foundation is for. I mean, this, there's nothing. And the last persons who should be shouting about it is our Trump supporters, given that all of the Trump kids are on this gravy train and everything they are is because of now, is because of what their dad is and because of selling their dad's name. I mean, Donald Trump Jr. was in India selling real estate a few years ago. He was in Hyderabad.
Yes, Pune.
Why do you think he was here? Would you think he would have been here if Donald Trump wasn't the president? Of course not. So what Hunter Biden did was no different. And if those things were not news, if nobody's making headlines of the fact that, you know, that Don Trump Jr. Was selling property in Hyderabad, and why would they make it for Hunter Biden? What's so different about that?
So would this thing swing any Democrat voters saying that
Okay. See, that's the thing with Trump. You know, in a marginal election where both the candidates, like if it was somewhere like, let's say Trump versus Romney versus Obama, or let's say McCain versus Obama, then yes, these things do matter. But with respect to Trump, it's that people hate him so much that this is a small drop in the ocean. This is not going to influence anybody's opinion because people will say, you know what? Yeah, okay, all right. But at least he didn't kill 200,000 Americans. At least he didn't collude with the Russians. At least he didn't do this. At least he didn't say that, you know, this is a Republican who is supposed to be pro-military, and he has consistently and persistently said that I don't like people who have died in wars because they're losers. I like the winners, the people who either didn't go to war or who left alive. So this is the way he actually thinks. So again, given that the person, again, I mean, this is a person who was so hated by the family of John McCain that they didn't invite him to John McCain's funeral. His daughter said, you know, there's no way that I want anybody from his administration to come to his funeral, given the way he was so nasty to John McCain, who was belonged to his own party. And by the way, in John McCain's funeral, there was George Bush and Obama sitting side by side. Okay. So this was a person who was well liked by everybody, Republican and Democrat. So he had, you know, his family had no problem with Democrats at all. But they had a problem with Trump. So if this was normal politics, then yes, this would perhaps matter. But when your other guy is Trump, whose level is way, way low, this is just a drop in the ocean. They would say, you know what? Okay, there are far worse problems with Joe Biden than the fact that his son made money out of Joe Biden's name. There are far worse problems. The fact is that Joe Biden himself isn't particularly there. He's not lucid in many ways. those things are more of a concern, people will say, than this. But at this point of time, even a lamppost is better than Trump.
All right. Okay, before we leave, quick prediction. I know you have kind of made your point, but on the U.S. election, do you see us getting a result when we have the podcast next week?
I don't know, honestly. I think that, again, this is something which I don't want to predict because I don't know. I don't know because right now, before data used to make some sense. If somebody had an 8 to 10 point lead 2 days before the elections, he would kind of confidently say that he is winning. But at this point of time, it's not a question of people who get more votes. Trump has so many other things that are playing for him, including foreign powers, including the hold of a court, that the full gamut of all the different tools that he has in his hand isn't even visible to most of us. We can only speculate what is actually there. So we don't know. So yes, if it's an overwhelming victory for Biden, then maybe he won't have the balls to do this. But if it is even close to being marginal, which I think it might be because of the shy Trump voter effect, I'm still saying that Biden is going to win. If we have a fair and free election, Biden is going to win. But if it gets close, then honestly, all bets are off at that point of time. I just don't have the data to make a prediction.
All right. So is that our episode for today then?
Yes, that is our episode for today.
All right. So we covered what? We started with IPL. You moved on to France and US elections for dummies for like me. And I get the feeling that next week's episode would focus a lot more on one of these topics. And anyway, do write in to us with your comments at the foursquare.net website, where we also have a link to Arnab's books on Amazon and his Patreon. So do take advantage of both these links. And until next time, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.